Welcome once again to the Reprobate Podcast. My name's David Flint, and with me today is Nicholas Schreck, author, filmmaker, musician, spiritual adventurer, and provocateur. We'll be talking about Charles Manson, COVID, and conspiracy theory, so stay tuned. So, Nicholas, how are things?
How are things in the world, or how are things with me? I think we know the answer to the first part, disastrous. To the second part, I have been doing remarkably well, despite the 300 crises and many apocalypses plaguing the world. And I've been quite busy producing creative work during, you know, while Rome burns, I have been fiddling. So I've been working on a great deal in the meantime.
Yeah, let's talk about what you've actually been up to in the last few months.
Right. Well, the last time we saw each other was in jolly old England in November. So, yeah. So since then, I have been completing the second solo album that I've done. The Illusionist came out in August of last year in Los Angeles, and on the autumn equinox, on September 22nd, Berlin Noir, which is my new album, will be released, and we've been working on that pretty much through this whole crisis, and even though the songs are mostly written beforehand, it is a very bleak and desolate album in mood, and I think it will be very suitable for the zeitgeist. Somehow it was almost as if the mood of the songs came to me before the manifold crises in the world, and I think they reflect them. Secondly, on a distinguished internet site called The Reprobate, we will be premiering two new videos for my EP that came out July 4th, which is I'm Afraid of America. And already we have a video of a cover version of David Bowie's I'm Afraid of America on my YouTube channel. But now we have made videos for the other two songs on the EP, and that's They and The Nice People. And I think they're quite unusual in my repertoire, in that really, for the most part, in all of the years I've been in the music racket, I have rarely addressed or deigned to lower myself to discuss current events or anything going on in the world. But this particular EP, and I doubt I will do it again much, but at the moment, it's pretty unique in that I wrote these two songs. They is about basically the conspiracy theory madness that is one of the hallmarks of our insane dark age. And, you know, particularly the right-wing version of these conspiracy fantasies, as I call them, because even to call them theories is to grace them with a dignity they don't deserve. And it's, you know, it's a comedic but serious parody of the kind of thinking and mood that goes into the this sort of conspiracy madness that is infecting so many people, and that I believe is a much worse pandemic than the coronavirus. And the second song, and this is a double feature, this video, the second song, The Nice People, I think will obviously be quite evident, is addressing the opposite of these two divisive duality partisan civil war conflicts, and that is the so-called left wing's obsession with political correctness and whatever you can call the absolute madness that they have descended into. And I think it will confuse people, which it is meant to do, because as I've always said, even from the beginning of my career, I am determinedly, not I wouldn't say apolitical, but I have nothing but contempt for all political parties, for all propaganda. And I think these two videos reflect my visceral disgust at seeing so many people, and even people that I've respected, sink into the lowest level of regurgitating partisan propaganda, no longer thinking and I do believe it is a very dangerous moment in human history that we're facing, when both sides of this equation, and I see them as being very similar in their fanaticism and their zealotry, in their refusal to look at facts and to be all about emotions. I think it's the beginning of a new kind of dark age, as I've said before. So I think there's an emotional contempt in these songs and in this video that reflects my own personal frustration with just this mass hysteria and ignorance on both sides of the equation, and the blindness of both of them thinking the other side are the evil ones, and just sinking into the most dualistic and primitive tribal thinking in the worst way.
Yeah, I think we're in a very strange situation at the moment, where we're caught between two tribes who, on the one hand, seem to be diametrically opposed, but on the other hand, are quite similar in their fanaticism, in their methods. And for those of us stuck in the middle, it's a fairly grim point.
That's exactly how I feel. I mean, I see them as both, they're so similar, and yet they don't see that they're basically, in their hysteria, in their emotionalism, in their total subjectivity, so equally removed from anything like an objective reality. And this is almost turning into a folk religion on both sides, where you must believe these doctrines and dogmas that they've come up with last week. And the other thing about it that is just so intellectually bankrupt, the ideas that both the new left and the new right, and I almost feel uncomfortable even calling them right and left, because they have mutated from something that is really no longer anything, particularly the American version of this, but you have it in the UK, I think, in a very similar way. They're not even truly conservatism or progressivism as we once knew them. They're out of any kind of historical context, and they've just become articles of faith, identity politics run amok. So it's all about emotion, and it's really not even about policy or proper governance. It's just about expressing your hatred of the other side. And obviously that can never work. You know, it's only going to lead to bloodshed, which is, seems to be what many of them want, which seems to, is almost a nihilistic death wish involved in it.
I suspect that the whole pandemic situation has just made this 10 times worse, because we now seem to have this point where what used to be a culture war online, that was people shouting and abusing each other, trying to cancel each other, trying to shut down voices, is now beginning to move offline, and that will only ever end in violence and destruction.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very clear that that's what's going to happen. And I mean, America particularly has, I mean, really, the it began, the thing that Americans revere, the founding fathers and the American Revolution. The original American Revolution was a civil war to begin with, more than a revolution. And it was also, if you look back at it, about emotion-based fantasy ideology, similar to the Soviet Union. I mean, the ideas of this jerry-rigged republic to fight England, the quickly put together foundations of it, really had something cult-like about them to the beginning. And, you know, so that was the first civil war in the 1770s. And then the second civil war was only 100 years later. And I truly believe that this is leading to something like at least a cold civil war. I mean, I don't think that either side has the discipline to mount actual, you know, military action. Though I know there's a lot of disgruntled veterans with army experience who would be happy to take out their hatred on the so-called other side. And I think that will happen. I think we'll see that happen. But this is something deeply wrong with America, you know, on a fundamental level from the beginning. And I think this hatred is a part of its DNA as a nation. And I do believe it will destroy itself. Like, you know, of course, as Spengler predicted, all empires must fall and decline. And I think, you know, we're certainly in the Nero Caligula Elagabalus phase of this empire.
It's interesting that you said that it's religious, and I see it that way too. It's become a secular religion, and of course, as we see with non-secular religions, they bring out the real fanatics because their belief is total. They can't see any other point. Either you're a believer or you're a blasphemer.
Right. Well, this kind of absolutist, dualist thinking, and particularly, I think one thing that is very disturbing about them is their total lack of any irony, sarcasm, sense of humor, self-reflection. And that too is, all too typical of religious fanaticism. So when you have, I should point out, I think a lot of people assume because of my former devil worshiping period that I have a problem with religion in general. And I really don't. On the contrary, I think one of them, as you said, this is a secular religion, this left-wing and right-wing ideological fanaticism. But the problem with them, both of them lack any true spiritual foundation. They're, as I mentioned, they're based on very flimsy pseudo-ideas that were hatched in the internet a few years ago. The right-wing obsession, with conspiracies and powerful elite. This sort of thing was exactly going on in Paris in the 19th century with the Paladin conspiracy, that the, satanic powers in high places. I saw it firsthand, yeah. Of course, in the 1980s with the Satanic Panic. This is real, this to me is all too familiar. For millennials and young people, it may seem new. But what shocks me is there's a lot of occultists and alternative esoteric people who once would have been repelled by the Satanic Panic, and yet they are embracing this without looking at the foundation of it, which a lot of it is going back. A lot of these ideas go back to the John Birch Society and, in general, fundamentalist Christian fantasies about satanic pedophilia. And, if you have even the slightest awareness of depth psychology, you have to wonder about these people's particular obsession with pedophilia, rape, from a Jungian point of view, what is going on in their subconscious that they are so obsessed with this purification of these particular paraphilias. So, but they are completely lacking in any awareness of the possibility that they could be wrong and any sense of humor or anything to give them some detachment. And the same is true of the left-wing fanatics and their absolutely Puritan, grim obsession that anyone who doesn't agree with their rhetoric and dogma that was made up a few weeks ago is a fascist or is their enemy.
It's that weird situation. I think we've seen this in the past with preachers who are virulently anti-homosexual and then turn out to have been visiting rent boys. They are so obsessed with something. What's going on there?
Yeah, exactly.
Whether it's the right with their obsession with the secret cabals of pedophiles, or whether it's the left with their obsession that everybody is racist. It seems like they're just seeing something that's within themselves and projecting.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned Carl Jung. I mean, it's just classic seeing the shadow in somebody else and not realizing that the shadow that you're fearing and hating is your shadow, that you're exteriorizing it. And this is so painfully obvious, like watching infants quarreling that have no self-awareness. And it's very hard to imagine what would wake them up from this sleepwalking state of terrifying certainty that their insane ideologies make sense to anyone but them. But that's the outer world. And as I said, for the most part, my work has rarely touched on these things. And I think it's rather a fluke in my work that this particular album, I'm afraid of America, or EP, addresses the zeitgeist and the modern era in a way that I have not usually done before or after. I usually try to stick to more universal or timeless themes. But honestly, there's nothing other than the Satanic Panic, where I was being personally attacked, and where law enforcement and the government were literally going after me on a personal level as part of a true witch hunt. I mean, that word is thrown around, but it really was a witch hunt. Nothing that I've experienced in my lifetime has actually made me so discouraged about the future of the human race as both phenomena, this twin phenomena. And of course, as you said earlier, which I meant to react to, frankly, although it will insult these people, it's like they were bored children that were kept inside while it was raining for too long. And clearly the corona lockdown, this would never have happened in such an intense manner. It would have stayed online, as you described, where it was, with this yelling, this eternal yelling match. And it came outside, I think, because, quite frankly, people became bored and they don't have any inner life. They don't really have any spiritual tradition or any philosophical guidance or wisdom to give them strength through this crisis. And they just flipped out. And I know that a lot of people will find that offensive because this is a matter of life and death to them. But I think they got bored like little children who weren't allowed to play and they decided to take their interior demons and let them out to play. And I think we're going to see very ugly consequences of that. And we already are.
Certainly. It seems unlikely that all the protests that have been taking place, particularly in the US, but also here in the UK, would have been happening, or certainly would have been happening with the same level of intensity if people hadn't been locked in. And as you say, just bored, looking for an excuse. And they've been forced to take it offline because they've got nothing else to do with their time.
Well, and that's what I'm saying, why this particular thing has discouraged me about humanity. Not that I had any great faith in it at any point in my life, but it's funny that, you know, everyone's supposed to wear masks, but what this period has done in a metaphoric way is unmask what's really going on with humanity. And it's pretty shocking to see how hollowed out Western civilization has become, how, you know, such shallow values, such shallow principles, ideas that have no roots, that are not connected to any kind of viable tradition. And it makes you wonder, all the wisdom of the ages, all the philosophers, all the spiritual traditions, all of the sustenance for getting through difficult times, which humanity has been faced with really much worse crises than this one. But the human race has become very weak and lacking in warrior spirit, and also lacking in the ability to work together as a team in any way. So this extreme individualism of our consumer age, and as you said, the need to be entertained all the time. So they created a mini civil war simply because they were bored, but they don't realize that's the psychology behind it. And of course, by our saying it, it's blasphemy because we're not taking their ideology seriously. They're dressing up their emotional tantrum in ideological dressing, but I think it's pretty clear what's going on. So, but you know, that's the outer world, and that from the tantric Buddhist perspective, samsara, the basic poisons that create disturbing emotions in this human world of hatred, of attachment, and of ignorance, we can see them very clearly right now. And for any spiritually minded person, in a true sense of spirituality, it's a lesson of how important it is not to become attached to worldly things, because this whole period of history, we can see the instability of governments, the instability of economies, the instability of counting on the future, or thinking, for artists, thinking that, you know, your career is going to happen tomorrow. Because so in a way, this has been an existential wake-up call to humanity. And I would say it gets an F on its reaction to it in every way. I have seen very little wisdom. You know, like even wars and other crises occasionally bring out the best in people. This seems to almost universally have brought out the worst.
It's been very disappointing because when all this started, we went into lockdown, I guess, mid-March. And I thought at that point that maybe this would give people pause, allow them to think, allow everybody to think we're all in this bigger picture situation together. But of course, that didn't happen at all. It just went the opposite way, as you've said. You know, people just indulged themselves more and more in their weird fantasies and their weird obsession.
Right. Yeah. I too was cautiously optimistic. And I even, in the early part of this, I cautioned my students that I have, to take advantage of this time, not to see it as a negative thing, but to actually see it as a reset. Because was there anything so great about the way Western civilization was going, you know, in the before time, before this happened? It really wasn't. So, I mean, the last time I had that kind of optimism was when communism fell in, you know, in the late 80s and 90s. I thought, okay, well, maybe this horrible period of stasis, of Cold War stasis between the Soviet Union and the United States, both of which, the values of which I despise, maybe that will end and European culture will return in Eastern and Western Europe. And I had some confidence that that would happen at the time of the Werewolf Order, and it didn't happen at all. Just the worst of both cultures only. And so, I had a little bit of confidence like you that maybe this will shock people enough, the lockdown, to wake up and look at themselves. But on the contrary, they are, you know, fervently ignorant. And, you know, from, again, not, that's the outer world. I have done my best to make the most of it and really worked very hard to stay focused on my spiritual practice, and also, even though it's a part of my spiritual practice, along with Berlin Wah, my new album coming out, which I worked on diligently throughout this whole thing and gave me a kind of focus. As the world was chaotic, it gave some order to it all. And then the I'm Afraid of America EP, which came out in July. And then finally, the much awaited or long awaited final ultimate edition of the Manson File, will be released in November. And I was able to use the time during the Corona crisis to finish certain problematic chapters about it that had to do with the events that occurred after Charlie's death. So the Manson File, the myth and reality of an outlaw shaman, will be published on November 11th, which is Charlie's birthday, and people can pre-order it now through a website that has been set up. And if you want to pre-order it, it is $39. Let me correct that. $39 to, and this is in lowercase, themansonfile.ecwid.com. themansonfile.equid.com. So pre-orders are already being taken, and the actual book will be delivered in November.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. Let's talk a little bit about the new version of the Manson File. When was the last one?
2011. And what happened there, I mean, really, these three versions of the Manson File, most people who have written about this subject, you know, they researched it for a few years and left it behind them. And that's why most of the books on the subject are inaccurate, filled with not only inaccuracies, but lies. But this has really been a good chunk of my life. I knew Charlie for 33 years, and the way the book began, the first version of the Manson File in 1988, was there was a book called Manson in His Own Words that was a sort of pseudo autobiography, an ex-convict named Newell Emmons. Charlie owed him a favor because of something he did for him in the underworld in the 1950s and 60s. And so Charlie allowed Emmons to do this book, Manson in His Own Words. And the first Manson File was basically Charlie was very angry when Emmons' book came out. He had some hope that it would be good, and he didn't like how the editors of the book from Grove Press had distorted his words, and there were a lot of inaccuracies in it. And to make a long story short, he and Emmons had a falling out, and he said to me, you know, why don't you make a real Manson in His Own Words? And so with his cooperation, the first Manson File came out in 88, which was the first time people had really seen what Charlie actually believed, rather than having somebody explain what he believed and distorting it grotesquely, as Bugliosi or Ed Sanders, or, you know, basically all anyone knew before that of what he said and what he truly taught and believed was distorted by his enemies, or used simply as a prosecutorial smear tactic to make him look insane. So when the Manson File came out, it definitely changed a certain level of perception about him. And then my film, Charles Manson Superstar, which was the companion piece, I can say, you know, really had a dramatic effect in making people realize that you have been lied to, as I've been saying publicly since 1987, that Vincent Bugliosi's prosecution was a lie. It, the narrative he presented of Helter Skelter was not true. And more importantly to me than the crimes, the distortion of who and what Manson was. So the first edition was like the beginning. And then in the 1990s, quite by accident, I learned from two people who were friends of Polanski and Sharon Tate and J. Sebring and Frykowski what really happened. And that really opened a gigantic, unexpected door to more information. Once I got that information from Gene Gutowski, who is one of Roman Polanski's best friends and a frequent collaborator on his films, and Ferdinand Main, who was an actor in Polanski's film The Fearless Vampire Killers, or Dance of the Vampire, they quite casually and out of the blue opened the door telling me what they knew of what really happened. And that led me to put two and two together and then do the, and I really didn't want to. I was done with the subject after being so intensely involved with it, but I felt almost a moral responsibility that this information had been given to me, that I had to make it known. So in 2011, the second version of the Manson file came out, and that went into, whereas the first one was mostly focused on Charlie's music, philosophy, and cultural resonance and spiritual ideas and ecological activism, the second book covered every aspect of Manson, his music, his spiritual ideas, his political stance. And in the middle of the book, which is basically such a long book that the part about the murders could be its own standalone book, went into detail of what the CLO drive slaughter was really about, which without, getting into, granular detail about it. Basically, it was presented as these insane cultists drunk on the idea or high on the idea of Helter Skelter, of starting a race war, went and killed random strangers. And that, for the most part, though it's been completely debunked, is what the average person on the street who has no reason to look beyond what the mainstream media has told them believes to this day. In fact, what I learned through speaking to many of the people firsthand and finally to Charles was that it was just an ordinary drug deal between, as happens every day and is happening right now, where, drug dealers are, they work on a friendly level, but they're also rivals. And Tex Watson and Linda Kasabian, a newly arrived member of the commune, went to rob Frykowski, Wojtek Frykowski, and Jay Sebring, who were operating a drug dealing network out of Polanski's home while he was away in London. And they had given a lot of money to Frykowski for the new drug MDA, which was the forerunner of ecstasy. And that was a big deal in the narcotics world, that there was a new psychedelic. And Tex Watson wanted to get the, corner the market on the street level distribution of it. So they had given Frykowski a great deal of money for a delivery of it, and they apparently either, and this I could not ascertain, they either didn't, Frykowski didn't deliver, or what he gave them was so-called bunk, that there was something defective. I'm not quite sure which. Yeah. I've heard both. In either case, they went back to rob them that night of the murders because they knew that a huge amount of drugs was being delivered for distribution. So, they were, that's how close all these people were. They were rival drug dealers, but they were also friendly, as we see in the narcotic underworld all the time. And the murders happened because of a series of unfortunate events that turned a robbery into a slaughter. And then afterwards, the crime scene was redecorated to make it look like something else. And actually to frame, as I explain in the book, to frame some other rival drug dealers who Wojtek Frykowski had actually raped a Canadian drug dealer named Billy Doyle. And what that whole crime scene was made to look like was as if these Canadian drug dealers had gone back and killed them as revenge. And it nearly worked because the police looked into that and arrested those people. It was a very clever framing device and it nearly worked. So that, you know, and that's a very brief description of what at least the Cielo crime was really about. And of course, the newspapers and the media thought that before Charlie and the commune were arrested. If you go back to the Los Angeles Times, that was what people thought it was. So I'm not really, you know, it's not like my brilliant scholarship has discovered something new. What I've done is confirm from the people who were involved that they were right the first time. It wasn't about a cult leader hypnotizing people to kill for him. It was a routine dispute. But one thing that Manson said is, you know, in the underworld, people are always killing each other. So it's like most authors are trying to make what they've discovered seem more sensational, more fantastic, more incredible. And what I'm saying, it was actually just a grubby, banal drug dispute, as we see every day. And it just got blown out of proportion into this gigantic myth. So the second edition, I sent it to Charles and he helped me a lot with it. But we got into a fight towards the end of it. He got the bizarre idea in his head before he got it that I was going to say that he was a federal agent. And where he got that, I assume that somebody in the backstabbing world of Mansonism said this to him. I don't really know where he got the idea. But suddenly, after cooperating with me, he became nervous about it and started to be hostile. And so when I sent him the book, he was expecting this ridiculous thing, which, of course, I never found any evidence of. But it was, as I said to him, kind of odd that he thought I would find that out because he knew how much research I was doing. So that's a weird thing in itself. But in either case, he got the book and he read it, or he had other prisoners read it to him because he had dyslexia. But he basically said, all right, he had helped me a lot with it, but I did a lot of independent research to verify what he was telling me and what other people said. And he said, all right, and this was 2011 or 12 when he received it in prison. Then he started to be able to call me on a cell phone, which he had never been able to do before. All of our conversations had been monitored. You know, there were 15-minute calls that you could make from the prison, but they were listened to by the guards. Or when I would meet him in person, it was never completely confidential because there were other prisoners, family members, not family members in the family sense. I mean, people visiting criminals in prison and the guards. So he spoke in code, or, you know, in metaphor. But around the time, and a little bit before this too, but around the time that this second edition came out, he then was able to start calling me in the middle of the night, his time, kind of funny, from his cell on a cell phone. And we were able to speak confidentially. And then he opened up, and he almost seemed to feel in the end of his life some sort of responsibility to get the facts right. And so he even admitted things that he had lied to me about before. Correct, for instance, if people of your listeners, if they really know the case, there was the shooting of a drug dealer named Bernard Crowe, whose nickname was Lotsapapa. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that's what started the ball rolling of these murders. And, you know, he told me the true story of what happened about that, which was quite different than what he had told me when I was younger. He admitted, for instance, that the LaBianca murder was a robbery, and he actually, rather than making himself less culpable, he made himself more culpable by admitting that he took cash taken from the LaBiancas and valuables, the word he used, I don't know what the valuables were, and brought them to the Straight Satan's Motorcycle Club to pay them off because they were extorting him. And that is why he went to Venice Beach that night to pay off the Straight Satan. So that, you know, for him, that was quite an amazing admission. He had been very vague about all that. And, you know, that and other things, for instance, in the musical section of the book, because people think the book's all about crime, but really that's only one long chapter. Because to me, the murders are not all there is to Charlie Manson. So in the music section, he was much more forthcoming than ever about many of the famous rock musicians that he knew and the recording sessions that were done, which basically Terry Melcher and Dennis Wilson and the Beach Boys pretended that they lost interest in him in 1968 and they really didn't like him after all. That isn't true. Up until the murders and even after, they were still in touch with him and they were still planning on releasing an album, which they were recording. And actually, he recorded an album tracks with the Wrecking Crew, one of the, you know, best known session musician ensembles in LA at the time. And he was being groomed as Carol Kay. One of these session musicians said that she met him through Brian Wilson at Capitol Records, and he introduced Manson to her as the next big thing of the 70s. So it's not only the murders that were covered up and that I have unearthed, but how much a part of the LA music scene at that legendary, iconic time that he was part of the whole Laurel Canyon scene. And one thing, I mean, just off the top of my head that he'd never talked about before was how well he knew Jim Morrison and what their relationship was like. There had been rumors about that, but he, and also through another Manson researcher, Ben Gorecki confirmed through Robbie Krieger that a lot of what Charlie told me was true. So we have that confirmed, and I spoke to Krieger myself. So, you know, there's an infinite amount of things in the 2011 book that were revised, corrected, and Charles gave me much more depth about. So this is as close to the actual truth of what happened as we'll ever know, I believe. And in saying that, I'm still aware there are a huge amount of mysteries that will never be answered. The more you know about it, the more enigmatic it becomes. But I think I've got, I mean, this is the closest I've gotten to, it's still the foundations of what happened. There are deeper things which questions will be asked when you read the book. But I think we have the general idea of what this was all about. And more importantly and germanely, how it was covered up. And that is, to me, the most significant crime is that the media, law enforcement, the judicial system, the Nixon administration, and all of your favorite rock stars in Hollywood and actors conspired together with the killers, really all of them with the same vested interest, to present this cover story to protect their own asses and to protect their own reputation. So that's what you will find in the new edition. I mean, a lot of it is the 2011 edition, revised and corrected, but there's a great deal of new information and two new chapters, one of them getting into things that I did not mention in the first book, and finally everything that's happened after Charles' death, and sort of a summing up of the whole phenomenon.
Why do you think it is that people are so keen to cling to the whole helter-skelter thing when the drug angle just actually makes more sense?
I wish I could answer that. I am puzzled at the again, sort of like what we were talking about, the modern right and left becoming a folk religion. The helter-skelter story was, it, I think a lot of people misunderstand my point of view on it, because it drives them crazy that I'm saying this thing that they want to believe. It's like telling little kids Santa Claus doesn't exist. They really want to believe it. It's almost like become a folk religion. It has to, and it's not only helter-skelter. The main false belief is that these ordinary scummy criminals looking to make money in a drug deal were hypnotized to kill. The implication of that is that Manson was able to control the minds of innocent people to turn them into murderers who would be willing to viciously slaughter random strangers. That's really what the story is. That's what fascinates people. And there's a sexual, almost pseudo-pornographic thing, is that I think people get off on the idea of this older man hypnotizing these nubile young women to kill for him. But that isn't what happened. It's not what happened at all. And I mean, why the helter-skelter thing is believed, when it was, even the jury and even newspaper people and media people I talked to at the time found it outlandish and ridiculous, and knew that this was just, has to be something to do with drugs, considering the people involved. I mean, Jay Sebring, it's like the most open of secrets. Everybody in Hollywood in 1969 who knew him knew that Jay Sebring was the main drug dealer to the stars, with very little competition. And I had to find out who were the others. You know, there was a network of people. He was pretty much at the top of the heap, and everyone knew it. He was called the Candy Man. And actually, this has not been covered by the media at all, but in the Hollywood Reporter, which is like the Bible of mainstream Hollywood, you would think would never want to admit this, Sebring's co-partner in his business admitted that he knew Helter Skelter was not true at the time, and that it was about a drug deal. And he confirmed what I had discovered independently. He confirmed from his own knowledge that Sebring had this nickname, the Candyman, which is actually Sammy Davis Jr., who was one of his biggest cocaine clients. That song he did, the Candyman, is a kind of secret tribute to Sebring. So, you know, this was very well known in Hollywood. But I think now, in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the Epstein scandal, which are very, very similar, and even does it, the case even does get into the pedophilia of Polanski and things like that, that were covered up. I think because of Weinstein and Epstein, people can now more realistically believe that the entertainment elite really would go out of their way to lie, to cover up, to pay people off, to make sure that the media presents a whitewashed version of reality, and that they would threaten people who tell another story. And the other part of it is the mafia was deeply involved in this. And Hollywood at that time was very much in the grip of people like Sidney Korshak, a name not many people know, but who was one of the most powerful entertainment lawyers in Hollywood. But he was basically, you know, a murder incorporated man in Hollywood. And he was very responsible for covering up what happened, along with Polanski and other people in the entertainment industry, like the late Robert Evans, who was very much a part of covering up what happened. So a lot of it is a story about the corruption of Hollywood. And it's really not so much about a crazy cult on the ranch. That's one strand of it, but they weren't really a cult at all. The real story is it's like big criminals covering up the crimes of little criminals so that their larger crimes are not discovered. So people that believe in the Helter Skelter story are basically believing an alibi that other criminals put forth.
And it's strange because you would think that at this stage, that's a much more compelling and a story that would much more feed into conspiracy theories than the whole Helter Skelter story.
Right. Well, I do think that it's going to change. I mean, for instance, in my work since 1987 in this field was always faced with, you know, incredible derision and hatred. And, you know, I was called a Manson apologist and a disciple. And, you know, people believed that I was just diligently writing down whatever he said without, you know, checking it or researching it or looking into it. And just basically I was treated like a lunatic who might as well be talking about the flat earth or the moon landing didn't happen. In other words, they believe that the fake story of Helter Skelter was the truth, and the much more realistic story, which there's tons of evidence for, the drug deal gone wrong, was a bizarre conspiracy theory. So that's like bizarro world. But exactly what you're saying, I think, unfortunately, because of what we were talking about before, this obsession with pedophilia, which Polanski and the group of people around him really were doing, not as part of some occult secret society, just as Hollywood always has done, going back to the days of the Nickelodeon, during the sexual revolution, maybe much more openly in the whole spirit of let it all hang out, baby, and do your own thing. You know, there was a lot more permissiveness, for better or for worse, about everything. So a lot of what was covered up was the sexual shenanigans of this group of self-admittedly hedonists in Polanski's circle who called themselves the Roman Circus. So a lot of what was covered up was just out of sheer embarrassment. They had a porno ring in which they were making orgy videos. And videos were a state-of-the-art new medium at the time, so the general public, they couldn't be leaked to them, so they thought that was safe. A lot of the things that were covered up really didn't even have anything to do with the murder, but they do tie into, and I've had to be cautious about even describing it, because they almost would confirm what these QAnon types think Hollywood is, this satanic evil empire of sex molesters and rapists. I mean, of course, there is that aspect of it. But it's not like it was organized or had anything to do with occultism. It was just corrupt, hedonistic people abusing their power. So I do think this will change. And one thing that I saw, like last year in August on the 50th anniversary of the murders, I gave a lecture called What Hollywood Doesn't Want You to Know About the Tate LaBianca Murders at a very well-attended and very well-received screening, 30th anniversary screening of my film Charles Manson Superstar. And we also organized with Lethal Amounts in L.A. and with several other collectors of Manson memorabilia, of his personal property, an exhibit. And these things were received without any controversy. Perhaps because, maybe because the Wicked Witch is dead, because Charlie's not with us anymore, and it's become historical rather than, you know, something to be frightened of at the moment. But I see a change in how I'm treated about it. For instance, the Los Angeles Times, that was one of the main pushers of the Helter Skelter cult leader story, interviewed me and gave me a fair shake and recommended people go to my film in their August 9th edition. So, you know, that would never have happened before. So something is definitely changing. And Bugliosi's death made a big difference, because he was a litigious bastard who would sue you and try to destroy you if you countered him. Although, strangely, he never did with me, because I think he knew that I had the facts right. He basically bullied people into not revealing the truth. And now that he's dead, I have seen slowly but surely a certain amount of skepticism about him. So I do think the tide is turning. Way too late for justice to be done. Truth is important in it for its own sake. So that is happening. But of course there will always be a pushback from the cult of the victims, of people that need the victims to be innocent victims and who would prefer this stark tale of good versus evil rather than a banal story of a bunch of people who partied with each other, fucked each other, took drugs with each other, and ended up killing each other over a bad drug deal. That's just not as glamorous. Yeah. Although it's certainly interesting to consider how vast the lie has been and the elaborate nature. And like you said originally, the mystery of why people find it easier to believe this bizarre, baroque, complicated story of the bottomless pit and race war and all of this, you know, when you can just, anyone who knows anything about human nature can figure out what is the more likely scenario.
Did you read that book Chaos that came out last year?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I not only read about it, rather than waste too much time. I knew Tom O'Neill well, the author. He came to me in 1999 and I gave him some information for the book. And I was quite astonished. I knew him for about 10 years at watching his transformation from a fairly credible reporter who I hope would go further in uncovering what really happened. And he took a detour into what I consider lunacy, this totally unfounded and unproven idea. I mean, he did. To his credit, I want to say he did uncover a great deal that totally debunks Bugliosi, which is great. He did prove that Terry Melcher was lying, that Rudy Altobelli, the owner of Cielo, and Bugliosi and Melcher were all conspiring to conceal how well Charlie, you know, knew them and how deeply involved he really was with them. So that part is great. Mm. I don't want to take that away from him. But the second part of the book, he gets into the really flimsily sourced idea that Manson was somehow trained by the CIA through somebody at the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic, just basically on insinuation and implication. So he accepts Bugliosi's idea that these people were brainwashed to kill, and he's adding that the evil CIA is who taught Charlie to kill. And the ostensible reason, I suppose, is because the establishment wanted to destroy the hippie movement. But the idea that this random, you know, this bunch of people of killing a hairdresser, a movie starlet, and their friends would destroy the hippie movement, is, you need a real lack of critical thinking to think that the CIA sat there and planned that. Or that, you know, in either case, there was no brainwashing involved. So I think Chaos, I would recommend people read it. The first part of the book is quite good. The second part, to me, having known Manson for decades, no way on earth was he working either covertly or unconsciously or in any way with the Central Intelligence Agency. It's just, you know, it's laughable. But now people are finding that believable in the as Helter Skelter is becoming, you know, less credible in the power vacuum. Interestingly, I see a lot of people in this conspiratorial era that we live in are, you know, finding it easy to accept this because they already have been primed to believe in the Illuminati and, you know, secret societies and spirit cooking and all of this nonsense. So they can easily accept the CIA. And the problem is a lot of these people just don't know how real power structures work, how real bureaucracies work, how real government agencies work. They're just people doing their job. They're not Blofeld. They're not Fu Manchu, you know?
Yeah, they're probably not that good.
No, they're not. Look at how much we know about their crimes. They're not really that good at covering up anything. You know, without getting into this whole thing, the Kennedy assassination, we can figure out from certain documents what they were lying about there. So if they couldn't cover that up very well, certainly the killing of Sharon Tate was not, you know, although it's become a legend and a myth, it was not like a national security issue.
Yeah. I think it's when you were mentioning Charlie thinking that you were about to expose him as an agent of the FBI, what he would make of O'Neill's comments about him.
Well, when I actually read O'Neill's book, I mean, I knew he was going in this direction. I wonder if somehow somebody confused it. You know, I wonder if some person with bad intentions was confusing the research that O'Neill was doing, what I was doing. It's possible. But I do want to say, because I have learned one thing. Like I mentioned in the book, when I was finishing the last edition, the one before this, Charlie called me and said, what's going on with the files? He never could get the name right. He always called it the Manson files instead of the Manson file. And I said, well, I'm trying to make sure everything is right. And he said in a wry tone of voice, well, whatever right means, what's right today may not be right tomorrow, or something to that effect. And that's certainly true. So with this case, honestly, the more I learn about it, the less I know about it, because the deeper you get into the details, the more baffling enigmas there are behind it. It kind of reminds me of what Winston Churchill said about the Soviet Union, a riddle wrapped in an enigma. I did challenge Manson on this. So I said, why the hell would you think I think you're a federal agent when I've been supporting your, you know, that you've been railroaded and all of this for years? And we had a kind of argument, confrontation about it. And then when he saw that the book, of course, didn't do that, he became extremely helpful in promoting the book. He put the link to the book on his business card. He would personally send the ISBN number to people. So I was very, you know, almost to make up for this argument, he was extremely generous and helpful in promoting it. And it was the only book ever written about him that he actually endorsed. But it was odd that he thought that. And of course, it couldn't help make me wonder, well, is there something to that in any way, shape, or form? Because the only little gleaming of that was he a few times mentioned that when he was released from prison, that there was some sort of deal made, that he said, I stuck to the deal and they still arrested me. That was very vague. And that's the only thing that remotely suggested, you know, could he have been sent out as an informant into the drug world? But, you know, that's completely speculation. I never found any proof of it. And he certainly didn't get any favorable treatment for doing so. You know, he did very hard time. So I can't see that the government paid him off for whatever, you know, people imagine he did. But, you know, I leave everything open, because tomorrow morning I could discover some new fact that will change everything. So that's a part of the territory of this very bizarre phenomenon.
I think it's always interesting with these stories as well, that we have this situation where people, they love the great conspiracy thing, because of course it's a much more dramatic story. I was thinking when I was reading the Tom O'Neill book, it put me in mind a little bit of Maury Terry's book, The Ultimate Evil, you think it's such a fantastic story, you really want to believe it.
Right. Well, that was sort of the chaos of its time, because I have to say, like O'Neill, Maury Terry, who now has been totally discredited and debunked, all of his nonsense about the Son of Sam has been disproven, and other murders that he claimed were part of the process, church, you know, murdering people. He did have little bits and pieces of very good research, and particularly into the LaBianca murder. He got some things right that nobody else had ever talked about, which I confirmed and found to be true. But then just the ridiculous, you know, farrago of nonsense and conspiracy bullshit. And that really infected people for decades. And I'm afraid the same thing's happening now, is people are just saying, it's all the CIA, you know. And this is just very simplistic. The CIA may as well be the Illuminati, for the way that these people think of it. You know, this is not the real CIA they're thinking of, but a fantasy, demonized shadow version of what is just an ordinary intelligence agency that is certainly guilty of horrible abuses. But, you know, the idea that they engineered these murders to end the 60s is just, it's nonsense. Of course, it's putting the cart before the horse. The Nixon administration and the media used the fact that hippies were involved with these murders to smear the counterculture, but that was after it happened. It wasn't like anyone set out to plan it.
There's that weird situation that we have where you can retool all these stories to fit whatever conspiracy you have at the time. So I guess Terry's book was very much feeding into that satanic panic that was around at the time. Now we have, as you say, you know, the fear of the all-powerful elite. In the 60s, it was the fear of crazy hippies. So you could, these stories can almost be anything that you want them to be.
Well, that's what having been a part of this thing for so long, in the 60s and really again in the 80s during the satanic panic, amazingly, the whole thing then was about the fear of occultism and Satanism. Now, nobody really thinks that the Manson Commune were a bunch of, bloodthirsty Satanists. But at the time, from this, you know, I remember when the case was new, and then in the 80s again, during the Reagan era, when everything was satanic, that was what people were afraid of. And actually, the other day, just to show you, it doesn't even matter which political partisan side, I saw somebody comparing Adam Schiff, you know, the Democrat of all people, saying doesn't he have Manson's eye? And I saw a Republican saying that Black Lives Matter, that their violent actions are as fanatical as the Manson family. And of course, that's the last thing Manson would have been supporting. So, you know, so the left wing demonize him, the right wing demonize him. He was very conscious of this and the immense pressure of being the world scapegoat for everything. I mean, really, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say the devil, Hitler, and Manson, there's nobody else on that short list of ultimate evil. And he just doesn't belong on that. I mean, let's say he ordered the killings, which he didn't. Why would that make him? I never have understood why that would make it any different than Al Capone or any other gang leader who said, go kill these people. It happens every day. You know, presidents do that too. So it's just very, there's some mystical religious aspect to it where apparently the world needed a scapegoat. And he became it. And I'm sure for the rest of time, you know, what was evil about it will keep changing. It was hippies. It's the CIA. It's the devil. It's this. It's that. All of the many ridiculous, you know, and even the LSD angle. Well, that was important in the 60s that you see, this is what happens. If you take acid, you'll start slaughtering pregnant actresses. That's forgotten. It's like the devil, like in my book, The Satanic Screen, as I go through each decade, what is evil about the devil changes according to the social norms and conventions of the time, because evil is a very flexible concept based on what's supposed to be good. So I think Manson is just going to continue to become a mythic folk figure. And actually, I begin the book with this quote that he said, where he said, well, after I'm gone, people won't even know Manson was a real person. A lot of people don't know that Dracula was a real person. And I think that was pretty astute. I mean, he realized he was very aware of how ridiculous it was that this petty criminal, who wasn't even a very good or successful petty criminal, was considered this like unprecedented mastermind of all time.
That's the very strange aspect of it all. And it's the weird thing about Manson as well. I was watching the Mary Harron film, Charlie Says, where they seem to want to have their cake and eat it. So on the one hand, they're trying to make him out to be this kind of pathetic loser, but he's also this pathetic loser who could then totally influence the minds of all these well-educated young kids. And you think, well, he can't be both, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, that is a strange part of it. The knee-jerk hatred. I mean, they do the same thing with his music. His music's mediocre. It's horrible. No wonder everyone rejected him. But in fact, they didn't reject him. People like Neil Young, the Beach Boys, Zappa, Jim Morrison, many, many others, people from Spirit and other more obscure bands of the time, they loved his music and they actually admired it. But they have to make him a loser who was rejected. And yet, as you say, it completely makes no sense. Yet he'd have to be one of the most powerful people in history who could just, you know, hypnotize women to kill for him in a few months. Like Linda Kasabian knew him Absolutely. For 1 month, knew him from July 4th to August something, you know, August 20th. Hardly knew him at all. Mm. And how are we to believe that he hypnotized her to kill or to go on this? I mean, and then what people don't realize is she had a long history of drug dealing going back to 1967. And I think this is true with all of my work, really every book I've done and my music. It's about what is the truth behind the myth. And even on a spiritual level, I mean, that's obviously what I'm concerned is. What is the reality behind this dreamlike illusion? And that's, I think, what's most important about the Manson thing is not the details of the crimes or who did what or who stabbed when, but how is it that this incredibly false story could last so long and have become viewed with such mythic power for half a century and with no sign of stopping, and yet it's a complete fantasy. It tells something very grim about humanity that they would accept, and also its need for a scapegoat. You know, the need to personify and incarnate the shadow into a human being is obvious in our secular world. He became the devil, you know, or at least right after Adolf, he's the worst.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely slipped into that whole pop culture aspect of the ultimate villain. And I think he's probably correct that people will forget that he's a real character and he'll just become, like Jack the Ripper, this mythical character that people think is somehow invented.
Right. Well, like you think of Jack the Ripper, you know, because you're aware of the pop cultural resonance, all the many films, horror movies that were made that present a different Jack the Ripper and different motives and different conspiracies. The genie is let out of the bottle. Manson is just going to be an all-purpose devil. But as I predicted a long time ago, I do see signs that because of the extreme hatred and demonization of him, like anything, that creates a counter reaction. And I do think we won't maybe see it in our lifetime, but I believe he will also become a religious figure and seen as a martyr because of the fact that it's just so grotesquely exaggerated. People go the other way and see him. I think and that has happened before with many hated figures that eventually, after they're dead, become sanctified. I mean, he would think that's crazy, too. He would have laughed at that, but he certainly saw both. So it's what's really interesting. What does it say about the human mind in our society that this petty crook was turned into this image of evil incarnate capable of anything? Why do people need that? Why do they need to believe in that?
You also have this whole thing of people have an idea of who you are that is not the reality based on their own built image of you that's been collated through various things or things from a long, long time ago. I mean, when I published Satan Superstar, I had one person getting in touch with me to say, you know, how terrible it was that I had you interviewed in here because, you know, you were just this neo-Nazi.
Right.
Monster. I had to kind of explain to him, well, first of all, read the interview. Secondly, you know, you're reacting to an image and it's an image that's very out of date, but you must get this all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this was something that, of course, one of the many reasons that Manson and I could get along as peers. I mean, when I contacted him, you know, he was already aware from looking at TV appearances, and we could relate to each other as knowing that people would believe any nonsensical rumor or legend about us. And I have seen firsthand, so I could sympathize with him, certainly not on his scale, but I get it every day. People I know to this day recently are taken aside by other well-meaning people and saying, well, you know how horrible he is and all the horrible things he's done, which are all wrong, all fantasy, mostly misinformed or in the wrong time period. So I've come to accept I have some karma of being people's scapegoat. And this was true all my life. You know, in school, if a window was broken, I broke it. I once walked by a fire in Hollywood from across the street, and there was a huge crowd looking at the fire. I always think of this as archetypal of my life. And the police came and talked to me, who was coming from the opposite direction, as if I was the suspect. And so that's just a peculiarity of my karma. And I have to accept it's probably because in many past lives, I have done crimes. There's something, I think, that remains of that. So I don't deny that there's a reason for it. But yeah, I've given up on even explaining who and what I am because people make up their mind based on fantasy. They need you to be something. And I also get people who idolize me wrongly too. I don't want that either. There are people who you know, who will whitewash me, and then there's people who will demonize me. Both of them are wrong. And ultimately, you can't do anything about it. But it's very useful on an initiatory level, because you see the kind of bullshit that people can believe, and it gives you a very thick skin, because, you know, that person that people believe is me is a fantasy. It's a projection. Yeah. And now, I also admit, when I was younger, I played with it. When I began doing what I did with Radio Werewolf, I had no idea people would be that offended, because I really grew up outside of society, like a feral child, practically. I lived in a very bohemian world. My parents were not conventional people. And so I just projected what was in my mind at the time. I had no idea it would be that provocative. And I was shocked at how easily offended people were. And I do admit I pushed it, because I do have a sadistic streak. So when I saw that it offended people, I pushed it harder and harder and harder. And thought, okay, if that you find that offensive, how about this? So, you know, it's my, in many ways, it's my own fault. It's like I met Alice Cooper a long time ago. Radio Werewolf was recording near him. And he's a perfectly pleasant guy. And he was saying to us, you know, you guys are real. Everyone knows, you know, when I'm done, I'm just an ordinary guy. And that's true. There is something to fear about me, but it isn't what people think it is. It's that's a fantasy. But I'm not, you know, I'm not like Alice Cooper or other people in that ilk who like nudge you in the ribs and say, this is all just a show. It's just an act. You know, I'm just an ordinary guy. I'm not saying I am, but I'm also not this thing people imagine. So in my new video, as far as to a certain extent, my public image has become part of my art, because so many projections are placed on me that I can, you know, I can almost play with it as an aspect of my persona, because this huge accretion of rumors and myths. So it actually becomes an interesting, you know, theatrical device to use. So for the first time, I sort of play that up in the video for They, because so many people over the decades have obsessed with me for their conspiracy theories. Left-wing and right-wing maniacs have projected their fantasies. I'm in the process, the Illuminati, everything you can name. I mean, I see stuff all the time. Being who I am has allowed me to look under the rock of what society is and see the kind of conspiratorial paranoid fantasies people have. And I'm blamed for all of them. And I think it's hilarious. So I thought I would use some of that. So in They, I actually use a video that some fundamentalist Christian, hysteric put up, taking a quote from me from a 1988 interview and interspersing it with supposed evil symbolism of the record industry and about mind control, which I have often been blamed for. And even people have said that my interviews in the 80s were setting out the scenario for the New World Order and lunacy like that. And so I actually have myself as one of these internet researchers looking into this fearful character, Nicholas Schreck. So I'm playing myself, I'm playing a character looking myself up on the internet, because I'm so used to dealing with this maniacal behavior and these accusations. I thought I should do something with it. So the introduction to They is like a little mini film in which I'm playing a character who is researching me and then going down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories. From being a practicing tantric Buddhist for many years, one is aware that one's identity is largely illusory, and it's an ever-changing, sort of like the persistence of vision in film. It's an illusion that each part of who we are is one person. And the deeper you go into meditation and Buddhism practice, you see that we are not a fixed thing. So in many ways, this bizarre aspect of my life and career, all of these conspiracies and projections that are placed on me, has actually helped my initiatory and spiritual practice, because it's very easy to see that I am not that person people imagine me to be. And you see the very fluid nature of identity. So there is a phrase in tantric Buddhism calling taking everything on the path. So it's been useful for me to take this bizarre way that I'm interpreted or misinterpreted, but it has died down a little bit in recent years. But some strange aspects of it are, I would say many people find my Buddhism more challenging and disturbing than my prior devil worship, because I think people are more disturbed by sticking to an ethical code and insisting on moral behavior and having a spiritual discipline. It's, I think in our society is so corrupt and decadent that devil worship is somehow more acceptable. But actually striving to do something positive, having compassion for other people, you know, a moral code, those things disturb people. So that's been very interesting to see. And then there are people who think Buddhism is just some deeper level of occult Satanism. So, you know, you can't win. There are people that think Buddhism, they're Christians particularly, think, you know, that Buddhism must be an even deeper, darker evil. So, you know, it's very interesting to observe. But I should point out that in recent years, actually in the past year or so, like for instance, a video that I did for that the reprobate showed the Futura model, which if you see it is completely not objectionable in any way. There's nothing that anyone could find objectionable. And yet several, you know, alternative music sites, you know, they wouldn't even consider showing it because of whatever they imagine its message to be and whatever they imagine me to be. And you know, and then even more radical or underground venues have banned me or pretty much blacklisted me. And that's been true for years. I mean, so I'm very happy to operate outside of not only outside of the mainstream, but outside of the underground, because even the underground is very squeamish and conservative for many different reasons, not only because of my supposed evil neo-Nazi satanic background, but then there's a whole other side of loyalists to Anton LaVey and believers in his satanic philosophy that hate me for betraying the doctor or for so, you know, so I'm hated by all sides, which is fine with me and in many ways serves my art and my spiritual practice. But as you started that out by mentioning how I've dealt with some of what Manson dealt with, yeah, absolutely. And that was a bond between us because he knew that I wouldn't judge him because I was used to being judged and lied about. So he knew that to a certain extent I could relate to him. And actually, interestingly, in 1989 or 88, I was going to work with Richard Ramirez, who agreed to let me and Zena do a book about him from his point of view. And we got to know him quite well. And he too, you know, he already knew who we were. He had watched me on TV being scapegoated, hated, and blamed. So he opened up to me because he could see that I was not coming to him from a place of moral superiority. So actually it's helped me in my research many times, and in the Manson file, having to speak to many criminals, some of them obscure players, they know, kind of, if you're outside of society, if you yourself are an outcast, then in a strange way, you can get people to trust you and open up to you more than if you're seen as a respectable pillar of society.
So, I mean, how easy has it been for you to actually make contact with some of the people involved in the Manson case and to get them to talk to you? I'm not talking so much about members of the family, but perhaps members of Sharon Tate's family or the other victims' families.
Yeah, well, Ferdy Main, the English-German actor, Zena and I became friends with him in the 90s in Los Angeles, and we knew him for a while before he happened to bring this up. We took him to the Magic Castle, which is the magician's central for the world. It's this Baroque haunted mansion-looking place in the middle of Hollywood. We took him to see a magic show, which seemed very appropriate because the whole case is about illusions and misdirection. And he just happened to mention in dinner, you know, that what people think happened about the case didn't really happen, that it wasn't that way. And then he knew a little bit about it, which our jaws dropped. You know, he knew some of the details, not all of them, but he said, there happens to be someone in town who does know everything about it, who was right in the middle of it, and he's been a friend of mine my whole life, and that was Gene Gutowski, who was a very close friend of Polanski, who was you know, in the middle of the production of Dance of the Vampires, Rosemary's Baby, and who lived with Sharon and Roman for a while at their previous house and knew, you know, knew his fellow Polish exile, Wojtek Rakowski, and some of these obscure Polish exile players who were in Hollywood. And he basically, we because of Ferdy Main's introduction, because he trusted us, we went over to his son's house. And for, you know, afternoon and evening, he opened up and revealed, you know, he spilled the beans on what they had been covering up in some detail. And he gave me leads that I then followed for many years. Once he gave me the skeletal framework of what really happened, it was actually fairly easy to figure out who to talk to. And I found out, of course, who would not talk to me. But to answer your question directly, of course, a lot of these elderly Hollywood types, if I don't ambush them, if I don't get them immediately, once they've Googled me and see that I was actually a friend of Charlie's, then many of them are horrified.
Yeah.
But I have to say, too, there are others who knew him and knew that he was not the demon that the media has projected, and they have spoken to me without a problem. So it's been 50-50. And there is, it was delayed because of the corona crisis, but I would have gone to Los Angeles in this past April, and I already had the plane ticket to go to begin working on a major documentary about the whole Manson case with Michael Brenner, who is Charlie's son, with Mary Brenner. And we do have a contractual obligation to continue that. So this will be a, you know, a quite mainstream, major, many, episode streaming series on one of the major streaming services that will cover the whole case, and the producer of it and the director are more than willing to break the taboos and actually take on Hollywood's lie. So hopefully when corona calms down a bit and allows film production again, that's all not happening, when it happens, hopefully next year we can continue with that.
No, that sounds good. So, speaking of when corona goes down, I mean, where do you think we're going for the rest of the year? We've got the US elections coming up in 2 months.
Right, right.
So, do you think Trump will win again?
I can't be a prophet about that. I hoped that it would not happen last time. I would say a country that could elect Richard Nixon twice, Ronald Reagan twice, George Bush twice, could easily elect this moron again. Absolutely. I think it's possible. And the thing is, he's the president America deserves. He is the most American of presidents. He is the naked face of what America is. And the people that love him because he is that. The people that hate him, I think, are in denial and think that that country is something other than it is. But, you know, to me, this is what hyper-capitalism and a shallow celebrity culture where the Kardashians are people of supreme importance. Why not have a reality TV host be a statesman, you know? But I'm not really interested in partisan politics, but I have always thought the American election system is antiquated and, you know, it's some, like so many of the things that are revered in America, it's this antique system that was set up, you know, in the 1800s that's no longer relevant. And, I mean, obviously I left with my feet. I left America many times. I tried to get out in 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. I thought that was a joke. This half senile cowboy actor. Yeah. Are you going to take that seriously as a leader, as a of any substance? So, you know, I'm almost disqualified because I have rejected my home country a long time ago, and I haven't lived there since 1999.
Yeah.
So I look at it as alien, probably as you do. I've never believed in the American dream, and I've never associated with America. I've lived in England and in Europe for most of my adult life, and in Germany for 20 years now, 21 years actually, and in Austria before that. So I look at America as a foreigner, and I'm horrified by all aspects of it, all aspects, not just the ones people think I would be horrified, but as I've said, and as this video that I just released should make clear, all sides of it I find contemptible and ludicrous. So, but anything's possible there. And the bar has sunk so low, even if he does not squeak by and win again, he opened the door. I mean, Reagan, a Hollywood actor, saying lines that already lowered the bar. But the problem with this is there will continue to be, I mean, it has been said that politics is show business for ugly people. And I've always agreed with that maxim. Mm-hmm. But now it really is just, it's practically like an adjunct of professional wrestling. This no longer has anything to do with real governance. It's just a form of real life entertainment. It is a reality show. And I don't think people of any substance or weight are going to matter in the political game in America anymore. I think it's reduced to some sort of form of entertainment. Who has the best one-liners? Who puts on the best show? Not who provides proper governance. But also, ultimately, I reject democracy. I mean, when I was a little kid and I learned that the average person on the street is who decides who runs the country, I thought that was the craziest idea I ever heard. So not only do I reject the American dream, I think democracy is a very flawed system that only leads to mob rule, which is what the ancient Greeks feared about democracy. Yeah, so I think this is what we get when we let uninformed, ignorant people decide who should run things. And I think the main lesson of these years, also with Brexit and many other things that have happened in the past 5 years or so, I would think it proves there's no conspiracy. In fact, to me, the most horrifying thing about this period of history is we see that nobody's at the wheel. Nobody's in charge. You know, it would be a blessing to have a super efficient secret society running things behind the scenes. But instead, I see nothing but incompetent chaos. And it's only going to get worse, certainly on an outer governmental level. So I find it hard to believe that people can think there are these all-powerful secret societies running anything. Because look at the sheer incompetence and chaotic nature of the planet at the moment. I don't see, it kind of reminds me of the scene in Apocalypse Now where Martin Sheen he's going deeper and deeper towards Colonel Kurtz, and he comes to this chaotic battle scene and asks, who's in charge? And the soldier says, oh, I thought you were. I think that's what the situation we're in the world is. Yeah, nobody's in charge. Yeah, if you look at the outer world, I think certainly you'd be crazy not to find it discouraging and depressing. But if you are concerned with inner values and spiritual initiation, we can take this whole thing as a lesson that we should not have faith in the material world because it's completely unstable and unreliable. And we who could have imagined, a year ago that the world would have transformed the way it has in so many ways, how many people have died, all of the economic and mental health catastrophe that this has created. So it is positive in the sense for those who have eyes to see, it should be a wake-up call. You better start worrying about your spiritual life and your inner life, because outer life is very unstable and there's nothing there to be attached to. So for a few, I think it can be an awakening. For most people, as we see, unfortunately, it's leading them to go deeper asleep.
On that note, let's call it a day.
All right.
We'll have the links to your latest videos up. We'll put the link for buying the book too.
Good. And then on the autumn equinox, Berlin Noir, my new album, will be released. So people will have a cornucopia of riches of my work. So I can retire for a little while and figure out the next thing I'll do. I think this phase of my activity is ended. Now I'll have to plot my next nefarious move. So thank you for your hospitality. It was a pleasure to speak to you as always, and all the best for the reprobate and all of your enterprises.
Well, thank you very much, and hopefully we'll do this again sometime soon.
Okay, thank you.